From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. Jeremy Hobson's off today. It's Here and Now. And it's President's Day. The sitting president started the morning off by blasting a former Justice Department official making the media rounds. President Trump tweeted, "Wow, so many lies by now disgraced acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe. He was fired for lying, and now his story gets even more deranged." McCabe is out with a new book that condemns Trump for his attacks on the FBI, includes his fears that the Mueller investigation could vanish in the night, and describes a briefing in which Trump told him that he took the word of Russian President Vladimir Putin over his own intelligence agencies. Former Attorney General Jeff Sessions did fire McCabe for what he called a lack of candor in McCabe's answers to questions about information leaked to reporters. McCabe has said that was just a pretext for doing what the president wanted, which was getting rid of him. Well, he sat down for an interview with NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson and Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep. Here he talks about that briefing between Trump and intelligence officials. McCabe says the meeting completely went off the rails from the beginning, and the president changed the subject to North Korea.
Well, he shared his belief that North Korea had not actually launched the missiles they had recently launched before that briefing, didn't believe they had the capacity to do so, and shared that he thought that because he had been told that by Vladimir Putin.
And NPR's Carrie Johnson joins us now. Carrie, that was one of the most shocking things we heard in your interview. Did McCabe have a theory about how the president heard this from Putin? When?
McCabe did not talk in detail about how the president may have had this conversation with Russian leader Vladimir Putin. He also didn't want to go into details about the nature of other communications that Trump and Putin have had or may have had since Trump took office. But McCabe said that example about North Korea is just one of many frustrating situations that he encountered when he was at the FBI about trying to brief the president on intelligence. He said the president did not seem to care about the opinions of his own U.S. intelligence analysts. Rather, he went his own way, sometimes sided with Putin, sometimes just believed something he had read or heard elsewhere.
McCabe also said he feared that the next appointee to lead the FBI after James Comey was fired would try to sweep the Mueller investigation under the rug. So what did he say he did to try to protect it?
McCabe said he opened an investigation of President Trump himself in May 2017, shortly after the president fired McCabe's boss, FBI Director Jim Comey. McCabe says he opened a counterintelligence investigation of the president and also a criminal obstruction of justice investigation to try to find out if the president had some kind of bad intent to thwart the whole Russia probe by getting rid of Jim Comey. And he said by opening those investigations through the formal FBI process, it would be very hard for President Trump to get rid of him, even if McCabe were later fired.
He also spoke to you about Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. This is also very explosive, saying that Rosenstein talked about invoking the 25th Amendment in the days after Trump fired the former FBI Director James Comey. This, of course, would allow Congress to remove the president in the case that he might be incapacitated. Let's listen.
The 25th Amendment was something that Rod brought up with me in front of others in a few of these meetings. I just want to be clear, though, at no time did I ever perceive that there was a legitimate effort underway by Rod or anybody else to remove the president under the 25th Amendment or in any other way.
Now, still, though, this has been explosive. I mean, people like Lindsey Graham are saying they want to open an investigation into this. Rosenstein's denied this, but he hasn't directly contradicted reports that he also offered to wear a wire to collect evidence when he visited the president. What did McCabe say about that?
Yeah, Rosenstein has said that he never authorized anyone to wear a wire, but McCabe told Morning Edition, Steve Inskeep, and myself that that's because the FBI considered the issue from a legal perspective and thought the idea of the deputy attorney general trying to wear a wire to record the president of the United States was off the charts crazy. They never asked for that approval, and that's why it never happened.
Well, as we said, there have been concerns, and here is South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday.
The deputy attorney general was basically trying to do an administrative coup, take the president down through the 25th Amendment process. The deputy attorney general denies it. So I promise your viewers the following, that we will have a hearing about who's telling the truth.
Well, there's going to be a lot of sorting out. McCabe was fired 26 hours before he would have retired, losing his benefits. The FBI inspector general concluded that he misled investigators about contacts with a Wall Street Journal reporter. There's some information leaked. Now a grand jury is looking into that. I know he can't really talk that much about it because, you know, of all the legal aspects of it. But what does McCabe say about that accusation?
We pressed him, Robin, and he basically said he never intended to lie to anybody at the FBI, anybody in the Justice Department Inspector General's office, or the FBI director at the time, Jim Comey. He says he has to be careful because a grand jury and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C. are looking at this matter now, but he maintains he did nothing wrong, and any misstatements he made were part of the chaos the FBI was operating under after the president fired Jim Comey.
Just very briefly, we have a half a minute here, Carrie. What do you think happens here? There have been a lot of explosive books. Does this just go away after this surge in interest? What happens?
Well, I think people are going to continue to talk in Congress and inside the Justice Department and the FBI about why the president is or is not listening to his own intelligence analysts. And I also think there's going to be a new batch of conversations that sprout up when Special Counsel Robert Mueller tells us what he's found.
Yeah. NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, let's turn now to Aurora, Illinois, where police are still looking for answers after a gunman killed five at the Henry Pratt manufacturing plant on Friday. Investigators say 45-year-old Gary Martin began firing shortly after being fired. One of the questions, why did he pass a background check to buy to legally purchase a handgun when he was a convicted felon? Well, it turns out applicants for Illinois owner ID cards are not fingerprinted. That happened when Martin later applied for a conceal carry permit, and the state then sent a letter telling him as a felon he was required to turn in his gun. The next question, what happened then? Well, while police look for answers, there's also gratitude. Five officers were also shot at that scene, but none were killed. All but one have been released from the hospital. This all reminded us of the recent spike in the on-the-job shooting deaths of police officers. In 1 week in January, an officer was shot and killed every day. And in 2018, there was a 13% jump in police shot on the job from the previous year. We called up Steve Graninger with the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund in Washington. They keep a law enforcement fatality tally. And thankfully, that January surge in officer gun deaths is down, but there's a caveat.
So we have a table on our website that we update every day that shows the total number of fatalities for this year compared to the same point in time last year. And while we were celebrating the decrease in firearms-related deaths for this year, I do note that we've lost six officers in traffic-related incidents compared to two at the same point in time last year. Now, those are small numbers, so they're small sample sizes, which then generates a very large percent change of 200% for that line item.
We are hearing that there's some science to show that police lights may play one role here. Many departments are switching to blue emergency lights because several studies show the color red is harder to see. It matches car taillights, for instance. But red may also have a moth effect. It may actually draw people rather than warn them away.
I've certainly heard that through some of my colleagues here at the Memorial Fund who work on our officer safety and wellness initiatives.
Others are saying that the problem is that the cars don't move over when they see an officer assisting someone on the side of the road. And also some of these fatalities have been people texting.
Yeah, you know, the move over law, Robin, is a really important one. It is the law in every state now. When you see a first responder vehicle with its emergency lights on, you're to move over, slow down, if and when you can, to give that officer and that motorist that they might be assisting the space they need to assist the motorist in a safe manner and keep the driver of the vehicles also safe so that there is that clear space just in case.
Well, some of the officers killed this year through those accidents, Dale James Woods from Ohio. He was hit by a pickup truck while trying to remove traffic cones from the scene of a crash. Clayton Joel Townsend from Salt River, Arizona, was walking toward a car that he'd pulled over. Another car, operated by someone who admitted to texting, slammed into him. This is a huge danger for police officers.
It really is. You know, if you think about the traffic that we all struggle with in our local communities, and you know, think about getting out of your vehicle one day when you're sitting on a freeway and three or four lanes are jammed, Imagine if that traffic was moving at normal speed and what it would feel like to stand on the shoulder of that freeway outside of your vehicle. That is the situation that many of these law enforcement officers find themselves in when they are unfortunately struck and killed outside of their vehicle.
So police on-the-job deaths in traffic up. But as we said, thankfully, on-the-job gun-related deaths down after a spike in them last month. There must be some feeling of relief that that number has dropped.
There is a relief. Any day that we move forward and don't lose an officer is a good day. And one thing that I have learned about law enforcement and working with them for a number of years now is they're vigilant and they have an eye towards the future to try and prepare themselves, whatever unknown they may face when they answer that next call for service.
That's Steve Groninger with the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund in Washington, D.C. Steve, thanks so much for bringing us up to speed.
Thank you, Robin.
And the takeaway, see flashing lights on the side of the road, move over. As the deadline to resolve Brexit approaches, attention turns to the UK's House of Commons and, presiding over the more than 600 fractious, rambunctious, sometimes rude legislators, the Speaker of the House, the inimitable John Bercow, known in the UK and increasingly abroad, for this.
Order!
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 Bercow is the House's loquacious ringmaster. He's also playing an increasingly important role in what kind of Brexit the UK may pursue. Lucky us, NPR's Frank Langfitt recently spoke with Bercow and filed this report from London.
Bercow, who served as Speaker since 2009, can sometimes come off like a stern schoolmaster when trying to keep parliamentarians in line.
Mr. Shelbrook, be quiet. I know you feel strongly, and I respect that. I'm not having you shouting out. You either undertake now to be quiet, or I strongly advise you to leave the chamber for the rest of the debate. Stop it.
Other times, Bercow can seem like a walking thesaurus.
People making an extraordinary noise from a sedentary position haven't got the slightest prospect of being called to ask a question unless on the paper. If they realise that and recognise their own folly. Jeremy Corbyn.
I met Bercow recently in his cavernous office overlooking the River Thames, and asked him how he came to speak in such a distinctive manner.
I think I probably acquired my speaking style courtesy of my late father.
Bercow, who grew up in North London, says his father was an armchair politician who loved to talk.
And he was given to speaking in paragraphs. He didn't split an infinitive. He wouldn't put a preposition at the end of a sentence.
Continuing to talk about his father, who died when Bercow was in his 20s, the speaker began to tear up.
He was a small business person. He ran a car business, not particularly successfully, but he was as honest as the day. And he was a good dad. He didn't see me enter Parliament, still less did he see me get to the position of Speaker. But I very much admired the way he communicated.
Bercow says he tries to use his gift of gab to diffuse tension. For instance, with members of Parliament like Carl Turner, the opposition Labour Party, whom Bercow says likes to yell at members of the government during debates.
It's quite easy for me, as I have done a number of times over the years, to turn to him and say, "Order, Mr. Turner, you are a very overexcitable denizen of the House. Go and lie down in a dark room and perhaps take some sort of soothing medicament and you will probably feel better."
Bercow, who's 56 years old and stands 5'6", acknowledges that some find him irascible, but he says when an MP is banging on too long, a speaker must instill discipline.
It's no good the chair standing rather limply and saying, "Well, does the honourable gentleman think that he perhaps might just possibly at some point consider resuming his seat?" Well, obviously that's not going to be effective. You sometimes just have to say, "Order!"
Bercow lives with his family in an apartment inside the Parliament building. In person, he's warm, intellectually engaging, and intensely curious. The vast majority of British people, however, do not speak like John Bercow. And Bercow's biographer, Bobby Friedman, thinks it's a put-on.
I think it's an affectation that has become part of his personality. He will never use two words if he can use 1,000.
Bercow denies it.
It's not based on contrivance. It's not a performance. It's not artificial. It's me.
While Bercow's style entertains, his role in Parliament is crucial, especially at this turning point in British history. As Speaker, Bercow chooses which amendments members will vote on, which could shape Brexit, the greatest challenge the United Kingdom has faced in decades. Bercow opposed Brexit, but unlike in the American system, the House Speaker is officially neutral, a referee, and the Prime Minister, who sits in Parliament, controls the legislative agenda. Some members of Prime Minister Theresa May's cabinet have accused Bercow of flouting long-standing rules to favor lawmakers who oppose Brexit, to the disadvantage of the Prime Minister, who's trying to drive it through. Bercow's biographer, Bobby Friedman, explains.
What we've seen recently is that John Bercow has ripped up precedent. So even though things have been a particular way for hundreds of years, John Bercow says, no, I'm just going to let Parliament do something a completely different way. So that's taking power away from the executive.
So that your listeners are clear, it's not for the Speaker to back Brexit or to block Brexit.
Instead, Bercow says his job is to support lawmakers.
The one consistent thread or current percolating through my political career had been a passion for Parliament, a belief in the legislature, an enthusiasm for the idea of representation, an idea that this is the theatre in which great causes are played out.
And so I'm wondering, why is it so important, do you think, to be an advocate for Parliament?
Because otherwise it would be dominated, almost completely controlled by government. In our system, we do not have a separation of powers, unlike in the United States.
Bercow's come under other criticism as well. Former staff members have accused him of bullying, which he emphatically denies. Bobby Friedman, Bercow's biographer, says under similar circumstances, other speakers would have resigned.
They were very serious allegations, huge pressure on him, but he just carries on regardless. And Brexit, I think, saved him.
Friedman says that's because members of Parliament, particularly those who oppose Brexit, were against changing speakers at such a pivotal moment. Bercow, who's been re-elected speaker three times, isn't ready to step down anytime soon.
At this very important juncture in our national life, there's a lot to be said for an experienced hand on the tiller. I don't think it's, frankly, time for an ingenue.
And he still has a lot of work ahead. Next week, the Prime Minister will give the House a progress report on her negotiations with the EU and could face amendments from lawmakers who want to prevent the UK from crashing out of the EU with no deal or even delay Brexit. And it'll be up to Bercow to decide if and when those issues come to a vote. Frank Langford, NPR News, London.
Well, turning to home, what's going on at Southwest Airlines? If you're flying Southwest, you might be in for an extended trip. The airline has declared an operational emergency, canceling about 100 flights over this long weekend. And according to a memo to mechanics obtained by CBS News, Southwest called for an all-hands-on-deck to fix maintenance problems. This comes after a CBS investigation earlier this month in which industry mechanics said they were pressured to overlook safety issues. Let's bring in Seth Kaplan, editor at Airline Weekly. And Seth, what do you think? Is this an airline that really has this many mechanical problems? 40 Southwest planes a day have been grounded for maintenance? Or is this part of the ongoing labor relations dispute the company has had with mechanics? What's happening?
Well, the only thing we can say for sure, Robin, is that they really are having this many mechanical-related cancellations. The root cause is indeed, as you said, the big question here. My math tells me that we're still at a point here where, a couple dozen or so mechanical-related cancellations a day. You do have labor issues, mechanics who have been waiting a really long time for a contract. So on one hand, the CBS investigation, mechanics who say, hey, we're being, pressured to overlook things that we shouldn't overlook. On the other hand, you have an airline industry that, by any other measure is as safe as it's ever been. Mm. So the airline in its communications that have been reported sort of seems to be implying that, hey, something here isn't adding up, and maybe people are paying some extra special attention to issues that they might not pay attention to at another time. That seems to be what they're implying, although they haven't said it in those words.
Yes, and to back up what you just said, Southwest has been locked in contract negotiations with the mechanics going back years. But let's listen to a little of this CBS investigation. It found some industry mechanics working for airlines saying they're pressured to overlook potential safety problems. Here's one. His voice has been electronically altered, again speaking to CBS.
I've seen people walked off the job and held on suspension for a month or more because they reported problems that they supposedly were outside their scope for finding.
So, Seth, which airlines were mentioned in this documentary? We know Southwest was one, but you know, who else, and what can we take from that?
They mentioned Southwest, they mentioned American, the FAA followed up on all of that, and in a few cases issued what are called corrective notices, basically said, yeah, there is something there. You know, this is tough in a safety-sensitive industry when, on one hand, obviously airlines want employees to speak up whenever there's an issue. On the other hand, you know, there have been times over the years where, related to contract negotiations and other issues, you know, all of a sudden you sort of get more of those reports of issues. At times, pilots' unions over the years, you know, the allegations that pilots writing up issues that, you know, maybe were weren't mission critical, maybe they wouldn't have written up at a different time. But it's a tricky line to walk because no airline wants to be the airline accused of asking people to overlook safety-sensitive issues.
Well, and by the way, the mechanics CBS spoke with, and again, they were industry-wide, but they said there were things like damaged brakes and fuselages, you know, very chilling, not just trivial problems. And now we have this memo from Southwest that's been obtained by CBS saying all hands on deck, or they could face termination. Look, if you are planning a trip and had hoped to go with Southwest in the next few weeks, should you be nervous about mechanics who are feeling threatened with their jobs unless they come in? And, you know, what's your sense, Seth?
Well, it's an industry that, you know, by the most important metrics of all, is as safe as it's ever been. No, I mean, I would fly Southwest just as I would any other U.S. airline at this point. In terms of the risk of whether you'll have an issue because of all these cancellations, tougher question to ask. I can tell you that usually these kinds of issues with labor groups get resolved, if in fact that's what's going on here, because obviously it's in the airline's interest to do whatever it can to get everybody on board with the idea that, yes, we have to be safe while operating the airline still.
That's Seth Kaplan, editor at Airline Weekly. Seth, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
When it comes to skiing, some of us think Alta in Utah, cozy, simple. But skiing is also glitzy, cushy, pricey, something only the rich can afford. There are a few nonprofit ski areas across the country, though, trying to change that and reignite a simple sport that's accessible to all, regardless of income. James Dawson of Boise State Public Radio takes us on a trip just a short drive away from Idaho's capital city.
One, two, three.
No village, fancy restaurants, or five-star hotels here at Bogus Basin. Most visitors drive in for the day, and a lot of them are families, many of which have been coming for the more than 75 years the ski area has been open. 8-year-old twins Scarlett and Vivian Chetwood have been skiing at Bogus since they were toddlers.
I love all the jumps and the secret caves and the passages.
Bogus Basin is one of just a handful of nonprofit ski areas scattered throughout the country. Its operating budget is roughly $8.3 million, and about 340,000 people come here in the winter, mostly locals. It's also where Scarlett and Vivian's parents had their first date. Their mom, Suzanne, remembers that day well.
He was like the classic hot guy out of the 90s.
That classic hot guy is Pat. He's been skiing at Bogus since he was six.
I remember driving up the road in the back of the station wagon, my mom driving and having to listen to my sister's music.
You know, the classics like Madonna, The Cure, maybe throw in a little Scorpions. He skied a lot of places, but the Bogus Basin vibe keeps him coming back.
All my friends that I grew up with in the 80s and 90s that we grew up skiing together, we now have our kids and our kids are getting up there. There's just such a tradition of the love of skiing.
Suzanne says she loves the Bogus vibe too, but the vibes at swanky resorts like Aspen, not so much.
Get out of the car and you're like, everybody's got mascara and the fancy outfit. And the thing about Bogus is, like, the most beautiful, you know, stylish women here will just be like, I woke up and put my beanie on and we're going to go have some fun. And I love that.
The next day, I meet the Chetwood family at Bogus for lunch. Sandwiches and fries served on olive green cafeteria trays. Pat's friend Jesse Weiss is here too. He's been an instructor at Bogus and upscale Jackson Hole and says the two ski areas are completely different.
What they say about Jackson is the locals are better than the pros. So Jackson has a much more serious vibe. Here, it's about being rad and having fun.
And that's part of how Bogus Basin officials try to make their ski area stand out. A day pass here is less than half the price at Jackson Hole and roughly a third of what you'd pay at Vail. And the low prices, new summer programs, and a focus on education might be working. From 2014 to 2017, attendance has nearly doubled and revenue is up from the lean years. Brad Wilson is the general manager of Bogus.
We're trying to really push ourselves out into the community and make sure that people know, one, how to learn to ski and where to learn to ski, and then come up and not have to spend a whole bunch of money to really see if they like it.
Wilson says focusing on making skiing accessible for everyone and introducing new generations to the sport isn't just a feel-good thing. It helps the entire industry, even the glitzy, high-priced resorts.
We're really feeder areas for all of those ski areas, and you know, we do it for ourselves, but they are definitely the beneficiaries.
By charging relatively low prices and attracting families, Wilson hopes to reverse an aging demographic and keep Bogus Basin and other nonprofits like it in Montana, Oregon, and Vermont open for decades to come. For Here and Now, I'm James Dawson reporting from Bogus Basin, Idaho.
Love the name. James' story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau. Question: what's the deadliest animal in the world? Think small. Really small. A fraction of an ounce. Well, according to the World Health Organization, it's the mosquito, and it causes millions of deaths a year. In 2015, there were more than 438,000 deaths from malaria, and cases of dengue, Zika, yellow fever are on the rise. All that havoc caused by a single culprit, the female Aedes aegypti mosquito, depositing deadly microbes as she sucks up the blood she needs to reproduce. If only she could be convinced to not bite. Well, maybe she can. A study out of Rockefeller University in New York has shown the trick may be diet pills, appetite suppressants. The study's lead author is Laura Duvall. She's a postdoctoral fellow at Rockefeller. She joins us from NPR's New York studios. Laura, welcome.
Hello.
So you say this all started out as a joke?
Yeah, so this was kind of a strange idea. So as you mentioned, we know that the females bite us, they drink our blood, and they use the protein to develop their eggs. Mm. Now, what people often don't know is that as the female is developing these eggs, she completely loses interest in biting people. And so we wanted to know what's happening in the female mosquito when she's uninterested in biting people. And it turns out that the same thing is happening in the female mosquito. The same kind of pathways are activated that you and I might experience after we have a big meal.
And we don't want to eat. And in fact, drug manufacturers have been trying to figure out how to use this thinking for appetite suppressants for humans because we have these receptors. So what did you end up doing?
So what we did was we got a hold of these experimental drugs. So these are drugs that were designed to target the human versions of the receptors. Mm-hmm. And they're actually initially designed by pharmaceutical companies, basically to be diet drugs. And so we decided, well, mosquitoes also have their own versions of these receptors. And so we fed these human diet drugs to our mosquitoes to see whether or not it would change their behavior. And of course, the big surprise to us was that it did, in fact, change their attraction to humans.
Well, and explain some of the ways you did different experiments. But you were really tricking these mosquitoes into thinking they were engorged with blood, to having the same feeling as the ones that did, that were then going about and making eggs and not thinking about biting someone. So first of all, you're working with mosquitoes, these tiny little creatures that you have in cages. I mean, do you get attached to them?
I would say that everyone in our laboratory has a real love-hate relationships with the mosquitoes. You know, we can appreciate kind of how good they are at finding and biting humans. But, you know, all of the research that we do ultimately has the goal of basically stopping these mosquitoes from spreading disease.
Yeah, horrible diseases. So you have these companion mosquitoes that are living in the lab with you.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the things you did that proved to you that the mosquitoes that were not engorged with blood, but that somehow had these appetite suppressants, had that same feeling of not wanting to bite?
Yeah, so what we did was we actually can kind of trick these mosquitoes into taking a fake blood meal. So we can use artificial feeders. So this is essentially kind of saran wrap wrapped around a pool of either sheep's blood Or in some cases, we can actually get these females to drink a meal that's just salt water. So this is something that they'll slurp up like it's blood, but because there's no actual protein, you know, just in salt water, the female's never actually going to be able to use this meal to develop eggs. And so normally, she figures out pretty quickly that this was an unsatisfying meal, and so she returns very quickly to trying to bite people. But when we add our drugs into this saltwater meal, now this female acts like she really did get this nice filling meal of sheep's blood. Mm-hmm. And so that was something that really convinced us that we had found a way to fool this mosquito into acting like she'd had this nice juicy meal.
Yeah, there were other experiments as well. But now you come to the question of what do you do with this knowledge? Because I'm imagining we know there are traps that are set out for different insects, but you don't want there to be, you know, traps set up with appetite suppressants across swamplands that good insects, productive insects, would then also use.
That's absolutely true. And I think it's all about how we would lure the animals into these traps. So if you were to use a trap that mimics a human, so something that has carbon dioxide and human odor, then animals like mosquitoes and ticks are going to be interested in coming into this trap. But animals like butterflies and bees, who don't really care about humans, won't be attracted.
And I mean, let's be clear. Those mosquitoes and ticks, they are. It's your breath. It's your smell. They are attracted to humans.
Exactly. And those are exactly the cues that we used in our study to ask whether or not the mosquitoes were still attracted to those to the humans.
Yeah. For instance, your stocking at one point, the stocking that smelled like Laura.
Yes, exactly.
Was put in the
trap. This is a very convenient way for me to test whether or not the mosquitoes are interested in finding humans without actually having to put my arm in the cage.
So what do you do to prevent a bee or a pollinator from going to a trap with the appetite suppressant in it?
So one of the things that we can do is we can make sure that these are drugs that act only on the mosquito's receptors, and in fact that there would be no activity in these other insects like bees and like butterflies. But as I mentioned before, if we were to put these in something, in a trap that's going to attract animals that are out hunting for humans, then that's a way to kind of limit it to those animals that are looking to blood feed.
But there are other questions as well. You really don't know what the effect is of having millions of mosquitoes flying around thinking they're having eggs when they're not. We don't, you know, there's always that unintended consequence. And then there's a cost, right?
So right now what we've done is we've shown that in the laboratory, using our laboratory mosquitoes, we can kind of use this feeding pathway to suppress their attraction to humans. But it's not really ready for the field yet. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I think is a really kind of innovation of this strategy is that this is not something that kills the mosquito. This is something that kind of directly targets her appetite, so directly targeting the mosquito's behavior to prevent her from being a good disease vector.
Yeah, but as we said, there are questions, but also accolades. You published your results in the journal Cell. Huge response. One researcher from the University of Kentucky called it a tour de force of technique and ingenuity. Right up there with Mark Cloudon is the University of Idaho. He's the one who showed that blood-fed mosquitoes don't bite, which, of course, is work that you worked off of.
Exactly.
Trying to make mosquitoes feel that they are sated with blood. I'm thinking that this might not only have the effect of stopping mosquitoes from biting, but also having millions of females think they're making eggs when they're not, which helps in not reproducing
more
mosquitoes. Yeah.
So that's something where a female who's consumed one of these drugs but a meal with no protein is a female who won't be able to develop eggs. And
right.
So that's a way to reduce kind of her progeny, so the next generation of mosquitoes.
Kind of sad, you know, a woman who may want to reproduce but can't. But still, it's a mosquito, so
it's hard to feel too sorry
right.
for them.
We're good with that. So what happens next?
So we have been testing this in the Aedes aegypti species of mosquitoes. And so this is a species that's an important vector for things like dengue, for yellow fever, and for Zika. But we think that it's likely that the drugs that we've identified will also be active in other mosquito species. So this includes things like the malaria mosquito, Anopheles gambi, the West Nile mosquito, the Culex mosquitoes, and maybe even also other blood-feeding animals like ticks. So we're going to be testing it in these other species that also carry these diseases.
And what are the questions, the environmental impact, the long-term unthought-about consequences that you want to think about? What are the questions you need to answer before this can go out into the field?
So I think that we'll always need complementary strategies. Mosquitoes have been quite good at kind of developing resistance to the insecticides and things that we've been using. But one of the things that we'll need to do before this is ready for field deployment is to test it against wild populations of mosquitoes instead of the mosquitoes that we have in our laboratory. Mm-hmm. And we'd also need to develop these compounds to be cheap and long-lasting if we want to put them out in the field.
Well, we wish you the best of luck for many reasons.
Thank you.
Laura Duvall, she came up with this idea. It was a joke. Let's give appetite suppressants to mosquitoes, but it has proven in the lab to stop them from feeding on humans. And hopefully in the field, it will stop them from doing the same and transmitting diseases. We'll link you to her study in the journal Cell. Laura, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And a quick note, this week scientists have their eye on another insect and climate change, something we're also keeping an eye on. They say warmer springs and summers are causing an increase in houseflies, which can in turn cause a spread of the Campylobacter bacteria that causes gastrointestinal distress. The research comes out of the University of Waterloo in Ontario, where a computer simulator showed that the number of cases of infection could rise by as much as 28% by 2050 in the province of Ontario, Canada alone. Summer temperatures they are forecast to rise by 4 degrees. So you add that to stories of helpful insects disappearing because of climate change? Not good. Many know that nuclear power plants rely on enriched uranium as the fuel to produce electricity. Mining it is a process that's complex and, it turns out, pretty inefficient. But a uranium mining plant in Wyoming has been given the go-ahead to try another process. It will extract more uranium, but it's also raising environmental concerns. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
Snow is falling over a long, isolated service road. Eventually, a few small pump jacks give way to an unassuming metal gate. It opens up to Strata Energy and its uranium mine. Inside a simply built office building, CEO Ralph Canode greets me. We walk over to a warehouse.
So we'll be entering what's called a restricted area. That's a classification that's...
It's a large industrial room with pipes and ion exchange vessels where uranium is hauled into. Right now, those vessels pump an alkaline solution, the industry standard, through hundreds of nearby wells to recover uranium from aquifers below the surface. The solution used to pull the uranium out is basically baking soda. But with weak uranium prices, that's not cutting it for Strata.
We have said publicly that at today's prices, the performance of this mine is not sustainable in the current market environment.
Uranium markets have been suffering from competitive renewable and natural gas prices for years, with plants closing down around the country. Wyoming is the number one provider of that uranium in the states. Since last April, Strata has been pursuing a new approach to mining that would extract more uranium. It wants to use a low pH solution, in other words, an acid solution. Canode says it would nearly double the rate of uranium recovery compared to the industry standard.
We believe it's a game changer for us, yes.
The company lists several other advantages to the acid solution, like less water consumption and faster extraction. Strata has already passed the first few regulatory steps to make the switch, and soon it could become the first mine to use an acid solution to commercially recover uranium in the U.S. You might be wondering why every company isn't using acid leaching if it's so effective. Outside of the U.S., half of the world's uranium is produced by in situ or drilled uranium extraction, and acid leaching is the most common form. That's according to calculations from the World Nuclear Association. Canode lists off the countries using the method.
Australia, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, to a lesser degree, Russia and China.
But the discussion whether to standardize acid leaching ended in the U.S. decades ago. Back then, several pilot tests raised concerns of groundwater contamination and restoring its original quality.
And since that time, the Department of Energy and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission have really tried to get companies to shy away from acid leaching.
That's Shannon Anderson, staff attorney with the Powder River Basin Resource Council, a group that advocates for responsible development of Wyoming's energy resources. A 1992 International Atomic Energy Agency report seconds that. It states, quote,
"The difficulty for restoring groundwater following acid leaching led to exclusive adoption of alkaline leach systems."
Unquote. It's difficult to restore because pH levels were too low, and it took longer than the other solution. Plus, acid was causing a mineral to build up and hurt flow rate. And it does just sound scary. Without all this context, it just makes Wilma Tope nervous, who runs cattle near the mine. Her in-laws also live nearby.
I don't want to be in the more or less discarded zone. So I think that all landowners, most do feel that water is really precious.
And she worries what would happen if the company had to close down, given they're already in a tough spot. Tope knows that acid is good at pulling uranium from the rock. Old tests show it's also good at pulling toxic elements out as well.
And then my question is, how is the cleanup going to go?
Strata's own white paper lays out the disadvantages, but adds modern techniques have overcome early challenges. CEO Ralph Canode says only 1.5% of the solution is acid, that the aquifers are confined, meaning there's no connection to drinking water, and that the company isn't asking for any standards to be changed for groundwater restoration. Canode even says restoration should take roughly the same amount of time, though older tests show it took longer. With those assurances from the company, Powder River Basin Resource Council's Anderson says she doesn't oppose this project. She just worries about the precedent being set for other companies in the region.
We're concerned about generally the state of the industry and don't want to see risky processes and procedures just okayed by our regulators, knowing that groundwater could be at risk.
Back at the site, Canode points out to where all the change will happen, out in the snowy field, where this area could become the first commercial site of acid recovery in the U.S. for uranium.
Everything you see out there will systematically be converted once we receive full approval from the Wyoming DEQ.
And if they're successful, environmental advocates wonder if it could spark a tide change in uranium extraction across Wyoming and the country. For Here and Now, I'm Cooper McKim.
And we have a salute to end the hour. You know that iconic picture of a sailor kissing a nurse in Times Square as America celebrated the end of the Second World War? Well, that sailor has died. His name was George Mendoza. He died yesterday in Middletown, Rhode Island at 95. It took years and some incredible forensic work to identify the couple in that snapshot by famed photographer Alfred Eisenstadt. The woman in the picture was Greta Friedman. She died in 2016. And if you look over George's shoulder in the picture, you can see his actual date that night, the woman who would become his wife, and famously say, "You never kissed me like that." But hopefully at 95, he had time to make up for that. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.